my Africa, men and women, which are all on the but the Casito Kabuchalo, Cas 7 in the morning, and then you get home at 5 in the morning. That's 22 hours of being on the streets and drinking alcohol. As in my air, if you kill the motherfucking, they are about the day, if you kill the motherfucking Rabona, and I'll come on to the motherfucking.
South African actor Warren Masemola at the memorial service of one of the most iconic actors in our country, Presley Chinyakai. He was in a not so subtle way letting everyone know that his friend had died from alcohol abuse and how we as a people had gotten to a point where we almost worshipped alcohol and partying. The comments he made sparked debate about black people's relationship with alcohol and how we as a people don't want to acknowledge that collectively we have a problem. For me, the question of alcohol abuse in the black community has always made me wonder its impact on how we engage with spirituality and whether or not if alcohol is causing so many issues in our society. What is it doing to us spiritually, considering that alcohol seems to be an integral part of our spiritual and cultural ceremonies? So, in this episode, I'm going to do a deep dive into the history of our relationship with alcohol more broadly, across history and across different cultures and time frames, to try to figure out what is the truth behind our relationship with alcohol and spirituality. I have made an entire episode on the history of black people and alcohol, but I think it would be helpful to run through a summary of how alcohol made it into the black community. See, most of us grew up in the narrative that alcohol was a tool used by the apartheid government to weaken the black community. And according to this narrative, the government introduced these mass industrial-sized drinking spots in townships called beer halls. These beer halls were strategically located, the narrative goes, at bus stops where black men were getting off when they were coming from work. The idea being that black men would head off or two or ten before they go home, having drunk all his money and ready to kick everything from the door to the dog when he gets home. But the reality is a bit more complicated than that. You see, historically, homemade traditional beer has been a part of virtually all societies for thousands of years. And we as Africans are not an exception. Utjwala, umqombothi, bojwala ba setso has been a crucial component of African life forever. So that's not new. When colonization came and many black people were forced off of their land and had to move to cities that were now popping up around the gold mines, many women also went to the cities. But life for them was destined to be far tougher. When black women began moving to the cities in the early 20th century, they came with courage in their hearts and survival on their minds. Some followed their husbands, but many came alone, determined to carve out a life for themselves in a world that gave them almost nothing to work with. Life was harsh, the laws were merciless, and passbooks or dump buses chained their movements, and the job market, well, To them, it was completely closed. So they cleaned, they washed, they sold what they could on the street corners, and somehow they managed to make a living. But even under those conditions, Black people still sought connections. Because singabantu, we are a communal people. We find strength in gathering, in sharing, and in remembering who we are. And when we gathered, there was always song, there was always laughter, and yes, there was always drink. Traditionally, it was women who brewed beer, umqombothi, for their husbands and for guests and for the ancestors. It wasn't just a drink, it was a ritual, a way to feed the body and the spirit. But the cities were different. There were many men without wives and many women without husbands. So the women began brewing and selling, and just like that, out of poverty and resilience, the Shebeen Queen was born.
For me, the Shebeen Queens were the earliest women entrepreneurs. They were the first interaction of feminists, you know, in that era.
To get a perspective on the realities of what happened when the Black women's resourcefulness collided with music and culture and people searching for themselves, I spoke to Muafrika Mukhati, an astute poet, a prolific speaker, an award-winning radio presenter and producer. Muafrika is a co-founder of Hear My Voice, an NGO that uses poetry as a catalyst to address social issues.
They created a space of belonging for Black people in the township. And this is even before the township. My maternal great-grandmother, or my mother's grandmother on her paternal side was not really a Shebeen Queen, but she was selling homemade beer, lemutsuku, you know, homemade tobacco. So for me, that excited me to know that, you know what, that entrepreneurial bone was there. And it allowed people to gather, because of some people, they don't want take away, but they want to sit, and it sparks conversation, and you know, everything comes out and the stories come out. But Shebeens allowed people to gather, to have conversation of what is happening in society, how we can, you know, of society's ills.
In her home, people gathered. They shared jars of mqombothi, sang songs from back home, and found joy even under the shadow of the oppressive system. The sharing of beer wasn't only about drinking. It was spiritual. It was communion. The music carried memory, and the harmonies carried history. Through song, they remembered who they were. Then came the gramophone. With it, the sound of Black American jazz. The rhythm of struggle and survival found a new home here, in the slum yards of Johannesburg. The fusion of sound and spirit gave birth to marabi, a rhythm of new life.
I could try to explain to you what marabi is, but I think it would be better if you heard it from the people who lived it.
Yeah, black keys and white keys, you play them both together and make marabi.
Yeah,
marabi. Marabi is smart, and it's got its time. Marabi is the shit that runs in the street. Marabi is old rotten teens, mabobolo. Marabi is young black girls walking the streets of the white suburbs with washing on their heads. Marabi says I live in the shit, and that's where I belong, George. That's where I belong.
I am here at the Market Theatre to watch a play called Marabi. It is set in the 1930s in Doornfontein in Johannesburg, and the production follows Mapongo, a man who is battling ancestral duty, poverty, and the rising tide of change. It takes place at a time when recorded music threatens live performance and war looms with hollow promises. Marabi explores the complexities of love, legacy, and the rhythms that refuse to be silenced. I am here to specifically speak to Norma Ngoma, an actress who embodies the character of Mama Bongo so powerfully that it actually feels like you're speaking to a woman of that time. The character of Mama Bongo is a woman in the 1920s and 30s, a black woman who is at that point the intersection of just about every battle that a human being could face. Yet she carries with her the spirit of resilience, and not just that, of entrepreneurship. She's fighting battles in her home, outside of her home, within herself, outside of herself. And because of circumstances, her most powerful weapon of survival is selling alcohol.
Okay, my name is Norma Thamsanqa Ngoma. Originally, I'm coming from Eastern Cape, eMdantsane. But now I'm going to clear up and clear up Evert Bokero report.
Okay.
Yeah.
What, for this project, what drew you to the character?
First, I didn't audition for it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I've worked with the director and the producer to some shows, Zababes and the SARS Industrial Theatre, and also because they've seen me performing at Market Theatre since I started here at the Lab in 1997 and I graduated in 1998, doing different productions with different directors. They've seen my work. So for this one, they just called me to come and be part of the Marabi, because it's a show that was done by director Bra Arthur long time, it's 30 years ago, but they wanted to uivusa kwakhona with the new energy, because they were the old guys abo late Ramulawa and the others who were part of the show before nabo mama late mama Nomhle Nkonyeni.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, I think I think the character Mama Nomhle Nkonyeni, it reminded him of me.
Okay.
Specifically.
Okay.
That's why I became the part of the All production, right. Marabi.
So what did you think of the character when you were reading about her?
When I read it, the character, it reminded me of my mom.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, it's not someone far from me, because what was happening, my mother used to brew mkomboti.
Okay.
Ekhaya dala. Okay. Long time ago, during my century,
yeah.
My era, because we used to do that, and I didn't go far. I just bring my mother to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
What kind of preparation did you have to go through, or did you put yourself through to get into that?
Get into that character.
Yeah.
Not much.
Hmm.
Not much. It was
because
just for me to
she
nqiba.
She was in you.
Yeah. It was just for me to nqiba all the things that she went through. Umabongo. And also I think somehow, somewhere there's me in that character, Umabongo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I had to bring my mother in, I had to bring myself in. All obvious.
What of yourself do you see in her?
The obvious part, what Mabongo is doing, brewing, that I do.
Okay.
Even at home, it's something that my mother taught me to do. You must do that. It's more like it's a ritual, or it's a tradition type of a thing. So I should do that. I'm the responsible person. I'm the only person who's left. So the responsible, I have to do. If funeke kubuyiswe umuntu ndime funeke mbuyisile umama ndim utata am specifically
because
we abuyisa utata umama uyakhatshwa utata uyakhatshwa phinda abuyiswa. That's what I did when my father passed away.
Okay.
I had to do that. I was responsible don't kombothi
for those ceremonies.
That was my responsibility. Mm. Still is my responsibility.
When you remember with your mother, what role did Mkomboti play in just the family life and cultural life?
Family in terms of when izinto ezingahlangani, for example, ubona kubidani bhubhile kuyamoshakala endlini ikhonto engahlanganiyo, my mother will brew umqombothi and then we'll talk to abantu abadala before azobrew umqombothi, awenze umqombothi. And also when someone is sick at home, that was something that we used to do.
Okay.
Umama yenze just to ukuphilisa besingayi kugqirha singabazi uthini ukliniki nintoni ntoni. La mqombothi will play a big role ekhaya ukuthi uyagula umntana, let's just do this. Kumoshekele khona ungahlangani khona endlini, ubrother wam uyambona khona okushotayo ebezavela dibanisa into zakhe athi makasele kuba uye kwehla.
But it was a constant presence as part of that process.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Umama Bongo, she comes from Ezilalini. She comes from the village.
Yes.
She arrives in Joburg. What does she find when she arrives in Joburg?
She sees ubona the beauty, the environment engafana sekhaya. And bear in mind, I think somehow, somewhere, Mama Bongo is me, because when I moved from Eastern Cape to Johannesburg, I came with a big, I didn't know kuthi ngizohlala phi. One, I'm here to study at the lab, but andiyazi kuthi ngizohlala phi. First and foremost, andiyazi language. Andiyazi language lapha eJoburg, because eJoburg ine languages
yes,
as much
it's,
as
it's multicultural.
Yes, iDoornfontein nayo, it was
yes.
Different languages, like Alexander type of a thing. So, ndizaniphethe le bag, ndikhwele train uDuladula. Ndizofika eJohannesburg. I ndifikele make theater, I do a lab. I don't know ndizawuhlala kuphi. Ndibuze ebantwini ikhona into. Anamali. First and foremost, anamali enough. Because ekhaya utata kasebenzi, umama kasebenzi. Banivumele nje ukuthi ndize because ndithathiwe. That's my talent. We understand. But ukufika kwam nje ndifike ndiphethe le suitcase ene efakwe igyasi, yonke into. Ndithe ekhaya bakufakela yonke into. Yonke into orhadebe, if ngorhadebe ijasi, odlamini ijasi, konke uyafakelwa. Hambe ndixelelwa ke nasebenzini because ayikho nanto uzawunxiba. But ke ndafika, ndafunda, ndagqiba. It's more like that because when I saw iJohannesburg, xa ndifike ndibone i-buildings, beautiful buildings, but ekhaya uyaliwe ukuthi i-route li-dangerous. We must be careful. We understand. I was very, very small like that with Mama Bongo naye. She was in that state. But after a while, after knowing the movement, as I said, Johannesburg, then she started to relax.
She, for me, I feel like she's an intersection of so many different things, you know. She's a mother, she's a wife,
yes.
She's a woman. She's a woman in the 1920s.
Yes.
You know, of a particular background. And I feel like there's so many things that are working against her, you know, at that time. One of them being that her marriage is also a challenge.
Okay. Of course.
You know, it's like, and I feel like where she comes from, marriage was something else. That's the other thing that I noticed, that ekhaya, marriage, mchato, is a whole different thing than when you find here. How does she now navigate this different iteration of what marriage is in Joburg?
I worked very hard so that I can put food on the table. You want me to stay here at home so that the next day you can tell me how lazy am I? God gave me hands to plow for myself.
If your daughter talks to a man like that, come and give one to a kid, set their own. No woman must be allowed out of the house.
What do you think you're saying, Mama?
No, what? Still calling the lies in this monarchy. How can she be a proper wife, a proper mother? Huh? You know what? I actually showed that I agree with her.
I want you to say that. Your head is full of sin like your cousin's sister. Lavish! Why didn't you marry her? Why didn't you do
women wanted to do. You can't be told when we're small for the rest of the year, this time for what? Instead, you put me for fat and sex. Who can understand that nothing but misery? You did not marry me, my boy. You paid nothing for me. To fast for my heart.
And Job, you see, I'll always compare Umabongo with me, Mama Bongo with me, because Umama no Baba, we are born and kule Umama no Tata Beshala together. They were like, even if Kunendenseka and Bunga Kubon, Umama, Ebun Sabandan, we are fish and Snoba Gunsek and Donu Tata, Une, Yasabanda Batala. Bana bantu baba macaleni we found that ubaba unomntwana with the other women but ibungekho ibona noba bayalwa bungekho bona ne ekhaya coming to my marriage not the this one of my real marriage when I came and met this guy wase komani ogade umthimkhulu married that man for 19 years akiri xa uchata kuthiwa nyamezela emchatweni. We are nyamezela. We must be nobindo dakwins and doni nyamezela. Because that's what I had in mind when I married this man. Even though bekunama hiccups and a good relationship naipina,
you must enjoy.
Yes. Yeah. Even if abusive, abandon abambingeke bayibone, because yeah. I will hide it. Yeah, but there was a time whereby I felt like this is too much. That's what is happening to Mabongo with Mabongo and Mama Bongo. There's too muchness. Now you feel like you need to stand your ground. You understand? So that was what was happening to me at that time when my ex, late now, pastor abused me. Even if we are an abuser, but abantwana mabangayiboni. I will go to the room, ayondibethela khona ndibuye ndize edani room ndisule ingathi andibethwanga ndihlale. Because I didn't want to show them. But ke lafika ixesha apho kubonakala ukuthi hayi nam I'm tired. And nabantwana sebebadala sebekhulile, they want to revenge ukulwa notata because they see.
There's this part where I don't want to give too much away. There's this part where she rolls up her sleeve and it's like, let's fight.
Yes.
Mabongo.
Yes.
I will beat you. I will kill you with my bare hands. You know, it's like she had reached a point in fighting. And I feel like in that moment, Mabongo is representing so much more than just her husband.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm fighting everything outside there.
Yes.
And now I have to fight, you know, in my own home. There's also one of, for me, an important scene where she says, God gave me hands
to plow for myself.
And in this case, the hands is Mkomboti.
I think during that era, Mkomboti was like an entrepreneur. Everyone was brewing. Even during my era, like the Eastern Cape, I remember before Mama, because sometimes they know when Mkomboti during the week, or sometimes Zanga wins the pearly nyanga or something. With that, they will send me to Ezansi, Yotenga, Iskali, because I've been doing Zwayo, Emakaya, Londole, Yotenga, Iskali, Bingakubonum to Pete Ibia. Nes brandy nentonton, Ibisiskali, Miss Tengis, Wotengis, Suskali, Esso, the 1 rand, Mdassel.
And that's the business.
Yes.
I feel like they were like the first entrepreneurs.
Entrepreneurs.
Very empowered.
Yes.
Another thing is, Umama Bongo comes from Emakaya, whereby a woman is seen in a particular way. You know, she has to carry a certain kind of dignity.
Yes.
And, you know, when she's married, the marriage gives a kind of a dignity. But now, when she's here in Joburg and she's starting to trade Mkomboti, it's like the women who sell it and those who become Shebeen queens, that business, it loses them that dignity. It's like for that very thing that you're doing, you are seen as, she's not dignified. And I feel like there's moments where even her husband takes advantage of the fact that he... she wasn't his first choice.
True.
It's like,
true,
these women are seen as lesser than
mm.
based on how they're trying to survive.
True. It makes sense. And bear in mind, when you see Doron Fontaine, when you see Alexander now, you have imagine it, Doron Fontaine during that era, you see Alexander now, you think there are so many people that are coming. How does it make you? You should entertain everyone. And some of the men, Amadodazai, they are not coming to buy Mkombot. They are here
to other things.
Yeah, for other things. And you have to entertain everyone.
Mm.
And your dignity somehow, somewhere.
Gets affected.
Yes.
Sure.
There's a lot that is happening.
But now she's selling this Mkombot to survive.
To survive.
To help put food on the table and yes. take Umata and Utaini to school.
Mm.
But now Umapongo is struggling with the alcohol himself.
Yeah.
How does Mama Pongo navigate that or, you know, deal with that, the fact that the thing that she's selling is causing issues in her home?
Mm. It's not good, but that's the only option. But that's how we make money. That's how we make money. There is a very, very conflict between wena and mna nendo deyam, obviously. And definitely ngeke kube mnandi.
If I say to you, Mama Bongo were part of creating the problem of alcohol abuse in Black communities up until today, what comes to your mind if I say that? How does it make you feel?
As Mama Bongo?
Mm.
Hey, you can say that. But the world is in sorrow, in pain. There's a lot that is happening in this world, but Mama Bongo cannot change anything. There was no way that Mama Bongo, even if she masitaga deciding up things, we can also survive again. The only option that she had at that time, that era, was Mkombot to make ends meet. Uba, I think somehow, she's thinking about her family, about herself, about the survival. That's all is in her mind.
She doesn't have time to think about society.
No, others. It's about her. It's about her family. It's about her kids, her family, herself. That's it. She doesn't care. Because it's about herself.
The play Marabi carries an immensely, immensely gifted cast of powerful performers. And I would encourage anyone who can to go watch it. It will be on at the Market Theatre until the 15th of February, 2026. The government saw Shebeens as a threat to order, to control, and to the system itself. So they passed the 1928 Liquor Act, banning Black people from brewing or selling alcohol. Police raided homes and smashed beer barrels and dragged women to jail. By 1936, more Black women were arrested for brewing alcohol than men for breaking the pass laws. But these women refused to give up. They buried the barrels underground and hid jars beneath the floorboards. They created faster, stronger brews to stay ahead of the raids. Yet those changes in how the beer was made, the newer ingredients that were used, had consequences. The nutritious low alcohol umqombothi once shared in the community was then replaced with more potent liquor, turning ritual into survival and survival into addiction.
From the time of Yamitsoku, now the cigarettes have been introduced. It's no longer umqombothi, and then now we have the cartoon, you know, or even the spirits that are coming through. The sound also changed.
Really?
The gathering of people changed. That's where now we have Yoshebin Queens. The townships have been formed.
So it's almost like the chemical content of the alcohol changed the whole atmosphere.
And with the sound, I would love to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. Like the alcohol, the cigarettes or the tobacco, and the gathering of people, it changes.
Mm.
It changes with time. You know, like, also somehow I'm like vividly seeing it in my head that, you know, it's moving. It's no longer about batho like wearing animal skin, limitsoku that way, nebadishilang kachilwa, and then limqombothi wasego. And then now we are moving from that. Then we are coming to the township.
Meanwhile, the government opened its own beer halls, built near bus stops and mines, so workers could drink straight after work. By the 1950s, alcohol sales were funding the municipal bills of entire townships. Black labor was paying for its own oppression. And still, the Shabin Queen endured, through the raids, arrests, and the stigma they endured. By 1994, when apartheid finally fell, at least politically, the beer hall was gone, but the Shabins, they were still standing. The story of the Shabin Queen is not simple. It's a story of empowerment and loss, of independence and addiction. But ultimately, it's the story of us. While this may explain some of the challenges with alcohol today, the use of alcoholic beverages in our traditional culture goes back as far in history as human beings themselves. The practice of libations, which is the act of offering alcohol during ceremonies as a way of connecting with the ancestors, is something that is present in nearly all ancient cultures around the world. The basis of the practice of libations is premised on a belief that human beings have a soul that lives on when the body dies. This soul goes on to exist in a spiritual realm that, though not visible, is intimately connected with the physical. Ancient cultures believe that those who have passed on can have a material impact on the lives of the living. They are seen as being closer to the Creator God. And because of this, it is believed that they can play a role of being intermediaries, as it were, between God and the people. What is very important to understand about how ancient societies viewed the afterlife is that it differs from the religious interpretations of heaven and hell that we have today. For indigenous communities, the afterlife is an extension, maybe a more elevated form of the physical world where those who live in those realms still exist, but it's still connected to the physical. It is believed that those in the afterlife have lives where they still eat and drink and sleep and work, and that all these processes are linked with those of the physical in the living, whereby the living can make offerings of food and drink in order to help the departed to do their work of either being intermediaries or to affect certain outcomes in the physical world. The actual pouring out of libations can form part of very complex practices that have extremely strict rules about when it is done, who it is done by, and who it is done for, and what the actual offering is. There are wide varieties of offering depending on the individual culture, but more often than not, some form of alcoholic beverage is always present. These beverages are usually made through processes of fermentation of things like grains in the case of Nkombo tea and other fruit like grape in the case of wine. The practice of pouring libations is often associated with Africans or at least indigenous societies, but it was actually very common in many ancient European societies. In fact, the word libations is derived from the Latin libatio, which is an act of pouring out, which comes from the verb libare, which means to taste or to sip, to pour out. What is interesting is that while most Western religious societies, they like to view the practice like ukuphahla and making libations and offerings to the departed as barbaric, the civilizations that these Western cultures are built on had these very practices as an important aspect of their spiritual lives. For instance, the ancient Romans had a specific funerary ritual that involved the pouring of libations in honor of the deceased. Roman graves had marble tombstones of different forms, and in some of these tombstones, you would find a hole that shaped like the funnel on the top. It would be a wide indentation that had a pipe-like shape that went directly into the grave. This hole was called an infundibulum. During funerary rituals, people would pour liquids like wine or milk or honey or oil or even perfume into the hole as an offering. Other items such as fruits and sprinkling of corn or a few grains of salt, bread soaked in wine could also be offered as part of the ritual. The purpose of funerary rituals in ancient Rome revolved around the dual transformation of the deceased as a formerly living person to a spirit of the departed, which in those times was called the divine manes. Inscriptions on some of these tombstones were carved in a circular form with a hole in the center of the inscription. This meant that if the person making the offering wanted to read the inscription, they had to move around the tombstone in a circle. This would add a particular meditative quality to the process. These tombstones with holes in them occupied an interstitial space between the realms of Roman religion and ritual and action and memory making, and it provided a physical location for the people to commemorate and to communicate with the departed while performing these rituals. The way in which the inscriptions were laid out, the offering of different textured foods and fragrant liquids such as wine and honey and perfumes created an embodied approach to libations. So now, if most ancient peoples from across the world used alcohol as part of their spiritual practices, why does it feel like today the issue of alcohol and its negative effects on society are a black people thing? If you were to look at it more broadly, if you zoomed out across the world and across timelines, there are actual patterns that show how there are similarities in how certain groups of people are affected by alcohol consumption. Throughout the world, the demographic that is most affected by the social issues caused by alcohol are people who have historically experienced colonization. From Africa to Australia to Asia and the Americas, the prevalence of alcohol is highest amongst indigenous communities than among non-indigenous groups. What this means is that there is a direct link between alcohol abuse and historical cultural trauma. I have to be honest and say that I really didn't want to touch on colonialism in relation to issues around black society because it does feel like a cop-out. It feels like a tired excuse that is born out of black people not wanting to take responsibility for their own lives. But perhaps we can look at the specific ways in which colonialism used alcohol as a tool to see if or how those effects still have a bearing on modern life. We have already covered how alcohol made it into the black community in South Africa. So now let's go elsewhere. say, Australia. The Torres Strait is a group of small islands situated between Australia and Papua New Guinea. The inhabitants of the island, like the Aboriginal people of Australia, were the first nations in the area, having lived there for over 60,000 years. The Aboriginal and the Torres Strait Islanders were colonized by the British, and during the colonial era, the British introduced alcohol as a means of trade and exchange. This would have dire consequences in very much the same way it did when the DOP system was introduced in South Africa, where farming laborers were paid in liters of wine. But the European colonizers didn't just bring weapons with them. They also brought diseases that ravaged the indigenous communities, whose immune system had not encountered these diseases before. What unfolded in Australia and the Torres Straits was wave after wave of pandemics of chickenpox, smallpox, typhoid, measles, and influenza that, according to some estimates, wiped out nearly 70% of the native people. These diseases spread so quickly that most communities lost their elders in just under 2 years, leaving behind a vast cultural and spiritual and medicinal knowledge vacuum. When realizing that the population of the natives was supposedly dying out, the colonial powers decided to intervene using the signature move of colonialism: land dispossession. Native people were moved from their land, supposedly as a way of protecting them by putting them in settlements and religious missions. The next step was to create policies of forced assimilation. Now, these could involve things like literally kidnapping children of native people and putting them into foster care with white people, or putting the children into institutions. This practice was so widespread that these children ended up being called the lost generations. The idea was to wipe out any connection the indigenous people had with their culture, their language, and their families. This led to lots of social issues like abnormally high parental absence, child abuse, and child neglect amongst the native people. This generation was completely disconnected from everything that formed their cultural identity. Another measure that was introduced to try to protect the native people was the prohibition of alcohol consumption, which by now had become rampant. The prohibition simply led to risky habits like binge drinking, where people were basically storing large volumes of alcohol in their stomachs just in case there were raids. To then try to solve this, as part of the assimilation process, the government opened up the legitimate sale of alcohol, but only to those native people who could demonstrate that they had sufficiently assimilated into whiteness. What this meant was that alcohol consumption became a symbol of class and, most importantly, proximity to power. Alcohol consumption became aspirational. This form of social engineering embedded into the psyche of the people the notion that the people who had made it in life drank alcohol and lots of it. And what we as a native people will do is to take status symbols to their absolute limits. The lasting impact of these policies is that today, Australian Indigenous youth are more than twice as likely than their non-Indigenous counterparts to die from alcohol-related causes. And alcohol-related social issues are disproportionately higher amongst Indigenous people compared to the Europeans. What we need to understand is that alcoholism in the Black community or in Indigenous communities is not just a vice. It is a culture, in the exact same way that any other practice like lobola or Thanksgiving ceremonies are. Alcoholism is a negative cultural phenomenon, but it is a cultural practice nonetheless. But here's where the link between colonialism and alcohol abuse becomes interesting. The extent to which colonized people struggle with alcohol doesn't just stem from being colonized, but more fundamentally, who colonized you? Those countries with higher rates of alcoholism amongst indigenous populations are generally those that were colonized by Christians. Do you know which countries have the lowest rates of alcohol abuse amongst the natives? It is those that are predominantly Muslim. This was part one of a three-part series, so be on the lookout for part two. My name is Fosoom Zinglande. Thank you for joining me on this episode of The Journey Quant. I wish you light, I wish you courage, and I wish you all the very best on your journey. Makwande.